what's going on here. A couple of years ago, Monday, Thursday, we gathered in the Calvary Bracken House. I don't know if any of you who was there or who remembers, but we talked about the way the table would have been laid out for that Last Supper. And I bring that up as an example of what banquets and meals, hosted meals, looked like in the biblical context and what Jesus is referring to in this passage. And maybe you can think of a lot of images of the Last Supper. What does it look like? Big long dining room table, everybody in chairs, and they all sit on one side for the picture. Well, in Middle Eastern culture, it actually sits at very low tables and reclines. Sometimes you hear that language in the Gospels of them reclining at the table because they would lean one arm on the table. And it would be what they call a triclinium, kind of like a horseshoe shape with one long side. And this is where the server would come. And so everyone would sit on three sides. And the host would sit down here at the end with honored guests on his right and left. And then in decreasing order of importance, down the table to over here. So the story of the Last Supper, Peter's pouting because where does Peter end up sitting from what we can tell? Over here. He's not too happy about it. And so there's this level of honor that's to that culture and level of structure and people sitting according to their rank, so to speak. Now, I don't pretend to know exactly how they dressed or how they determined these things in the time of Jesus, but we do know that in Old Testament culture that there was a level to which one's honor was worn on your garments. And the edge of your garments were tassels that would hang off. And certainly in Jesus' day, they had tassels that would come off their prayer shawls, and even today they do. In one's kavod, meaning one's weight or importance, also literally means weight or fat. If you're too heavy, it's your kabed. It has to be your importance, and that would be displayed with medals and things on the edge of your garment. So you could literally see who the most important is according to the values of that culture. Not all that different from our culture, if you think about it. Depending on what your values are, if you value wealth and money and influence, you can look around and see where people fall in the pecking order, so to speak. So I want you to think about that as we read this story that has to do with the table and where people sit. Luke 14, we'll read verses 1 and then verses 7 through 14. On one occasion, when Jesus was going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on the Sabbath, they were watching him closely. When he noticed how the guests chose the places of honor, he told them a parable. When you are invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not sit at the place of honor, in case someone more distinguished than you has been invited by your host. And the host who invited both of you may come and say to you, give this person your place, and then in disgrace you would start to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down at the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. He said also to the one who had invited him, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, in case they may invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Well, Facebook reminded me this week that it was 4 years ago, around this time, that we arrived in Princeton, New Jersey. That September, I started classes for my second master's degree, with the hope of getting into a PhD program a rather inadvisable move to move away from your employment with your family to live in student housing and to take on big tuition debts. What I had learned up to that point was that there were very few positions in PhD programs, especially for those studying the Hebrew Bible, and even fewer jobs if you should make it through one, which made everything exceptionally competitive, especially when the average applicant was 25 and fresh out of prestigious schools, and I was not so young at 38 and had been pastoring a little church out in the boonies. My classes at Princeton Seminary met in a big old slate roof house that housed the bulk of the Old Testament department. It was a room with tables clumped together in the center. We all sat around, and we started sizing each other up from day one. Because we all knew Princeton's program only took one student each year. And most other programs did the same that we were all applying to. There were two PhD students, one who came in each of the 2 years of coursework, and the rest of us were doing a THM, as myself, a one-year furthering master's, or were MDiv students finishing up and planning to go on. We were a little cohort of about 8 students that took all our classes together. And so we began trying to impress our professors in order to get that coveted letter of recommendation needed in order to get into schools by the end of that semester, competing for the eye of our professors so that we might sift to the top of this stack of applications that come around January 15th. And like the guests at the banquet table, we were hoping that we would be the one invited to sit closer to the head of the table. I discerned very quickly that Colin, my friend, was brilliant, a natural linguist, already had a paper approved for publishing, read like lightning, retained it, and was likely to have his pick of programs, which was indeed the case. And so I conceded right off, well, there's no chance of beating Colin. He's got the first spot. But Travis, you know, he was bright, but I thought I could take Travis. I'm smarter than him. I can handle him. And Brian, he didn't seem as dead set on programs. He's a little more wishy-washy, and if needed be, a good push down the stairs would take care of him. Austin was hard to read. She had her sights set on the PhD, but word had it that she had crashed and burned in a presentation the prior semester. And so that was both a warning to us newbies that it only took one misstep, and it was curtains. But it was good news, and that she was probably done. Jacob was a different matter. He seemed like a mad scientist, and I couldn't tell if that meant he was a genius and would have that other chance, or if he was too far over the crazy scale and would not be considered. He had a little meltdown mid-semester from the stress. I remembered all this as I thought about the banquet table in our passage of Jesus observing everyone sizing each other up, eyes towards the head of the table, taking the seats of honor for themselves, wanting to be close to that place of importance as possible, to sit close to the host, to be seen as a person of significance, of rank, of honor, of smarts, being recognized, being looked up to. That is where everyone's attention is directed. Certainly not at the other end of the table, on the average ones who did not quite make it to recognition or accomplishment, but somehow made it onto the guest list. Well, in my year at Princeton, it was the possibility of getting into PhD programs that of winning those letters of recommendation, of being seen as the up-and-coming, the smartest among the smart, sifting up to those few places of honor, sitting on the right and left hand of scholars in the field. That was the prized possession. But I wonder, what is it that we look up to? What is it that we look down the table for? What are the seats of honor that you desire? What is it that captures our gaze and our motivation and our anxiety and our energy in our day-to-day lives? Is it recognition? Is it financial security? What seats do you vie for? Whose eye do you wish to catch? Whose banquet do you want to get invited to? Whose seat do you wish you were sitting in? Is it the person whose family are all around them, their kids visit often? Or is it the person who doesn't seem to have a worry in the world? Who is it? Where do you fix your attention? Where are the places you would like to be seating? Whose banquet are you hoping for an invitation to? In what direction is your gaze? Jesus sees folks taking the seats of honor or sitting as close as possible to the head of the table, and he suggests that within the custom of the day, they might play it a little more conservative. This is his first piece of advice that he offers in this passage. Play things in a way that would increase your honor rather than diminish it, is essentially what he's offering, a little bit of wisdom. That is, what happens if I take the seat next to the professor only to have Colin Cornell come in and take it from me and everybody watch me walk to the end of the table? How embarrassing would that be? Rather, Jesus says, take the lowest seat and let the host, if he deems appropriate, be the one to say, come sit in this seat of honor. Southern modesty, really, isn't it? Isn't that what he's advocating for? Refuse at first. Oh no, I really couldn't possibly eat that piece of pie. And when insisted upon enough times, then you can say, oh, I guess one piece. And then you look as humble as can be. Isn't that right? Southern hospitality? Southern, whatever you call it, modesty? No big deal, really. I mean, I knew as much going into Princeton, that you don't seat yourself too quickly. You earn your stripes and you wait to be moved up. Well, it is a risk, I suppose, because there's always that possibility that you take that last seat and no one recognizes you, and you stay sitting in that last seat, while those other seat grubbers take the good spots, and there you sit, unnoticed. Well, this is a risk, but so far Jesus is still working within the general paradigm of this fascination we have with the head of the table. The fact that our gaze is still fixed in that direction, with who's sitting over there and how we would love to be over there if the circumstances would just shift a little bit. But then Jesus leads over to the person who invited him to the banquet, and he says this: you should really consider your guest list. Jesus advocates that rather than having your eyes fixed in the one direction, like everybody else, to turn them in the opposite direction, looking to the end of the table that represents the lowest in terms of rank and honor. And what is more, Jesus says, to look even further in that direction, well beyond the end of the table, to those that would never even get the invitation to the banquet. He proposes that rather than be fixed on the seats of honor at the banquet, to become host of a banquet for the shamed, those on the periphery. Fix your gaze in that direction. When you give a luncheon or dinner, Jesus says, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, in case they might invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Jesus is again, as he is accustomed to doing, messing with the whole culture of meals and the principles of ritual purity and cleanliness. For the poor, well, you might be able to clean them up and get them into the banquet without catching too much attention. But the crippled, the lame, the blind, those who are sick, those who are unwhole in some way, these are not the type that the wealthy and the honored, the holy and the influential share their dinners with. These people have nothing, as Jesus points out, with which to reciprocate. In our culture, where we tend to kiss up to the rich, where our laws are written by corporations and their lobbyists, where we worship security and position, wealth and style, looking good and living good, being loved and respected, I wonder if we are guilty of spending all our time with our eyes focused in the one direction. joining in the culture around us, wanting to be among those honored at the table, wanting to move our way closer to those coveted seats. But what if we shifted our focus? What if we set our gaze in the other direction, on those uninvited, on those who would be seated even lower than we would, for whatever reason? In my first semester of that year at Princeton, our little cohort had the wherewithal to recognize that the decisions of professors were out of our hands, as were their logic for making decisions. And so we chose camaraderie instead, working and learning together and gathering together to celebrate and mourn each other's progress or lack thereof. I did get into a PhD program, believe it or not, and here I am, out here in Denver. And midway in my first year, I applied to be your pastor, and you hired me. We all make mistakes, but thank you. And for me, the return to ministry was a welcome balance. For I realized that when I was a small-town pastor up in Catskill, New York, your life is about being open and present to others. Your own voice and ambitions are pushed to the margins, not really called for most times. But on the flip side, to go into the competitive world of academics, it was all about oneself. All about one's progress, one's CV, about doing whatever you can to sift to the top so that you can be the one of the few to get that seat and to get one of those scarce jobs out there. And it became clear to me how incongruent these postures were, at least for me, how jarring and disorienting. One, a focus on serving where you have to work hard to maintain your sense of self even, because it's so much about others. And the other, where the focus is all on yourself, on self-advancement, parading and presenting one's own qualifications to the end of time at every possible opportunity. And I wonder if there isn't a general incoherence or incompatibility between the ambitions of culture, of the values of honor and wealth and security, of being right, of having respect, of looking important, and the call to love people unconditionally, regardless of their status, regardless of their dress or their accomplishment or how perfect their bodies are or how well they fit in socially or whether they have any accomplishments whatsoever. And if we could at least acknowledge the hold that those honored seats have on us, maybe we might be more freed up to refocus our attention on being a host in this world, being a voice and a source of hospitality to others, rather than being so focused on ourselves and our own needs. We might instead become focused on others as Christ, loving others as Christ has loved us. It is a hard call, I think. I find it to be so. A challenging proposal. It is about living in this discord between the values that we too are caught up in and the values Christ calls us to live out. And as I think about living with this conflict and this discord, I think of those who looked down the scale of rank and saw me and invested in me, who invited me into their lives. And I think of folks like Larry Lahr, the local Young Life leader in Canandaigua, New York, or Tom Feetz, my pastor and mentor, who saw an ignorant young person with potential. Maybe their examples can help us to imagine how we might follow the call of Christ to set our gaze on others further down the scale, those not invited to the banquet, and all God's children say. Would you join me in our song of response, the servant song.